Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Roz Rose the Pacific is brought to you by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
This is Roz Rose with Roz Savage and Dr. Kiki, episode 65 for Sunday, May 16th, 2010. It's a scratch and sniff world. Welcome, everyone. This is Roz Rose the Pacific. This is the show where we follow along and check in with Roz Savage as she travels in her rowboat across the Pacific Ocean. This is year three, the third leg of her journey, and she is about 3 weeks into her journey so far, and it seems that she might be finishing up rather early this year, but we'll find out more from her when she gets on the line and when she calls into the show today. On the show today, we are going to be talking with Dr. Gabrielle Nevitt from UC Davis. She is an expert in foraging and olfaction. What that means is using your nose to find food. So we'll be talking with her. We have a link. We can actually link what she does to Roz out on the Pacific Ocean. So you might find it really interesting. Roz is out there. She is a force of nature, progressing along, sustained by the food supply that she has on her boat, the water pump that's purifying the salt water of the ocean to give her drinking water, the solar panels that are giving her power, and the power of her own muscles to propel her from Kiribati, where she began three weeks ago, to Papua New Guinea, where it turns out she's probably going to show up in a couple of weeks. She just reached the Solomon Islands, according to her website, rozsavage.com. And hopefully, I think I read in one of her blog posts that she actually had some avian visitors, some boobies visiting her boat over the last few days. So she's started to get a bit more company than maybe she's been used to while she was out alone over the open ocean. Now, Gabby, hello and welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi.
So can you tell us, you've been out doing research over open ocean and looking at birds and how they forage over the open water. Can you tell us some of the challenges that you might have come up against as you were doing your own research?
Oh, well, it's nothing like what Roz is coming up against, because I've always been on ships or bigger boats than what she's on. But, you know, we've worked mostly in the Southern Oceans down in the South Atlantic, where I'm sure Roz has encountered in some of her blog posts from her Atlantic voyage, you know, huge waves, you know, 40-foot swells and that kind of thing. So the sea states can be very, very difficult for humans who aren't necessarily adapted to, you know, to face those challenges on their own. For the birds, however, this is where they thrive. So many of the birds we study are pelagic. They live most of their lives at sea. They're almost like fishes of the air. You know, they fly through the air close to the surface of the ocean, and they aren't tied to land the way birds, we sometimes think of birds being. They're really very ocean-going animals. So they're really interesting. She's lucky to be in their presence out there.
Yeah, I just think, imagine being out, you know, attached to a rowboat and looking up into the sky and seeing a single albatross or a petrel or, you know, just a lone bird out floating, you know, soaring through the sky over the water. And what a difference in perspective it must be from the bird's perspective to, you know, the perspective of the human on the water.
Oh, yeah. And also something to think about with these petrels and albatrosses, they actually are flying fairly close to the surface of the water. So they're not way up in the sky like you might think of some of the other tropical birds, perhaps like the boobies or the tropic birds. They're actually very close to the surface of the water. So in a way, Roz is a little bit like an albatross. Looking at it, I thought, she's got a very different perspective on what it's like to be out on the ocean, so close to the, to the elements. I mean, right in the middle of it all. And we'd really love to talk to her about some of that, because she's got a really different perspective, probably on that environment than probably very few modern people can have. It's an envious position to be in. For example, one of the things we study is how these seabirds find their prey, find their food in the open ocean. Because if you think about it, it's sort of like searching for a needle in a haystack. And yet for them, what might look featureless to us is actually sort of a rich landscape full of sort of features they can detect. The birds we study happen to have a very good sense of smell. And so I was wondering whether Roz noticed different scents over the ocean. These have been reported in other cultures and things of that nature. So, for example, when you go over a productive patch of ocean for a bird, it smells quite differently. There are compounds that are released by phytoplankton that make those productive areas, ring out like a beacon. This is where you find food. It's sort of like a landscape over the ocean with peaks and valleys, where the peaks are places that smell in a particular way and where food is likely to be available. But I imagine when you're that close, like Roz is on the ocean, you might have such a different perspective of what it's like to be out there than you would from a ship or even from a sailboat.
Yeah. Would you know what kind of sensitivity is necessary to be able to detect these patches of phytoplankton? I mean, you said that they're like beacons. With our human nose, there's the dog nose, there's the human nose, there's, the avian nose that's meant for hunting for food over the open ocean. What kind of...
in the southern oceans, in the southern Antarctic Ocean, things like that, the concentrations of these compounds that have been measured are in the picomolar range. So that's very small. That's 10 to the minus 12 molar. So it's we can smell in that range. It's just very at the limits of our detection capability for most scents. We suspect that other animals like seabirds and many fishes, just their sense of smell is so much greater than ours. It's even hard to imagine what their world must be like in terms of odors and what they can detect compared to what we can detect.
So, yeah.
And it might be, in certain cultures, primitive, other cultures, I don't want to say primitive, but other cultures might have a better sense of smell than, say, our culture. I mean, we live in a sort of a polluted city environment, for the most part. We're not, we spend a lot of time in air-conditioned buildings or buildings, with filters. And it's interesting with your sense of smell, because it's, unlike your other senses, it's extremely sensitive to the environment. And so the receptors that detect odors in the environment become replenished, if you want to put it that way. You get more of them if you're in an odor-rich environment.
How
so if you want to train your sense of smell, you go to smelly places where you can, pick up odors. You can train your sense of smell to be pretty astute if you're inclined to do that.
Oh, I love that. I love that. I'm going to break in for a second. I believe Roz is on the line. How does it smell out there?
it's something that I miss when I'm on the ocean. It doesn't really smell of anything. Out in the middle of the ocean, it doesn't really smell very oceany. So, no odors to report today. Although I'm actually almost within, nose shot of dry land at the moment.
Yeah, tell us about that. Is this last week we spoke and you we were talking about the fact that you were about halfway, and what's happened in the last week?
Or even in the last few hours. I've been up since 4 o'clock trying to avoid smacking into Cape Henpan. When I went to bed last night, I was drifting quite happily westwards and looked like I was nice and safe, but conditions changed during the night. And I checked the GPS at about 4 o'clock to find out I was on collision course. So I've been up and rowing, and at the moment I'm about 2 miles away from what looks like a very nice white sandy beach. And I see cliffs and trees, but it looks very deserted. I'm not too tempted to drop in. And I think if there was a beachfront bar, I might just have been tempted, but I'm definitely trying to avoid this particular bit of dry land.
Yeah, maybe wait for the bit of dry land that you really want to get off the boat on. Find your dock.
I think so, yeah. In fact, it's been quite an eventful day so far because... Oh. Apart from the dry land situation, my water maker stopped working this morning, and I broke my only pair of sunglasses.
Oh no!
So hopefully that's my three bad things in a row, and hopefully we can get on with the next phase now.
Are you going? Do you have a backup water maker?
I do. I think it's a battery problem. I haven't really had time to investigate because I've been too busy trying to avoid shipwreck. So once I've got safely past this cape, then I will investigate the problem further and see if I can sort it out.
Yeah.
But in fact, probably I've got enough fresh water in reserve to avoid having to use the manual water maker.
So
hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. But if you do need to, you're near dry land.
Yeah.
Maybe there are people near. Are these the Solomon Islands?
Particular bit look very uninterested. Don't think I would fancy trying to find fresh. Well, I suppose in all those cliffs there might be some nice waterfalls and streams, but no, it shouldn't be necessary. It shouldn't be necessary, hopefully.
Well, I'd like to introduce you to Gabby Nevitt, who is an olfaction and foraging expert. And we've been talking about the sense of smell that birds use to be able to hunt for food over the open ocean. And I was thinking it was particularly timely since you've been visited by a few boobies recently.
Absolutely. Or maybe I should be asking about the foraging and how do I detect fresh water?
Yeah, that I don't know. But that's exciting.
I suppose I would just make landfall and then try and listen out for the waterfalls or some such thing. Although, actually, it looks like there's a big squall heading my way, so maybe I could actually catch some fresh water as well. Well, hello, Gabby. Very nice to meet you, and thanks for being on the show this week.
Yeah, nice to meet you, too. It's inspiring what you're up to, boy. I mean, to say the least.
Thank you. So, I'm quite intrigued by the sense of smell of booby birds, because these birds absolutely stink. So I'm hoping for their sake that their sense of smell is not as is less developed than mine.
No, well, boobies are a different group than the ones we study. We study petrels and albatrosses, which are have very, very large olfactory systems. But boobies are thought to be more visual than olfactory. So, but the stink is probably... Yeah, they're probably very ammonia smelling or very fishy smelling.
Yes, a blend of the two, I would say. I mean, maybe they think that they smell wonderful, like lavender or lilies of the valley. Maybe it's just my perception that says that they stink. Maybe they think that I stink.
Are they landing on your boat, or are they just flying around it, or landing in the water, or...
A couple of them have roosted overnight on my boat and left their souvenirs behind.
I see. Wow.
I'd love to see some albatrosses, but I don't know, do albatrosses frequent this part of the ocean?
You might see some petrels. I'm not sure so much about albatrosses. There's a, I suppose where you are, you might be seeing some of the birds out of New Zealand, actually. They're very hot, wide-ranging birds, but it depends on whether, you know, you're going over really productive waters or not. So you might see Tahiti petrels or Gould's petrels, maybe some shearwaters.
Now am I right in thinking that petrels have got that distinctive kind of W shape of their wings?
Yeah, they have a very a dynamic soaring sort of wing, so they don't flap like a booby might. They're very, very narrow, long wings that are a bit bent. And then you'll see, and they have, if you can get close enough, they have a really distinctive face. They have a great big bill and a great big tube nose on it. So they, and they're really nice birds. I hope you do see some.
I do.
There's a really rare albatross that might be around where you are. They nest on an island called, I think it's Tarashima in Japan, and they're called the short-tailed albatross. And they go up into the Alaskan waters. They're extremely rare, and they, but you know, I've heard of them in your area, so they you might see them, I suppose. They're just extremely rare.
They'd
be the biggest bird you see, I'd imagine. But when you get down into Australia, you might see some a whole lot of other albatrosses down that area.
Yeah,
so you might see wandering albatross or royal albatross, things like that.
So, Roz?
Yeah, actually, I won't be making it to Australia till next year because
it's just not possible
for me to get that far south. So, I'm planning to make landfall in Papua New Guinea, but then I'm intending, if I manage not to shipwreck between here and Madang, I'm intending to attempt the Indian Ocean next year, for which I will have to get my boat shipped. Yep. So, I will need to get my boat shipped to Perth in Australia for that.
Nice.
So, yes.
Yeah.
This is, I would really, really like to do the Indian Ocean. That would mean the big three, I suppose, the Atlantic, the Pacific, and the Indian. But let's take it one at a time. I need to make sure that both my boat and I make it safely to the end of this stage before I really start thinking seriously about the next one.
Yeah. So, Roz, we were talking about the fact that there are these phytoplankton schools, that places where phytoplankton clump up in the open ocean, and they're stinky. They smell kind of fishy, and we were just wondering if you happened to if there were any distinctive odors that you came across while you're out over the open ocean. Was there anything that just kind of hit you out in that environment?
About 5 or 6 days ago.
You're breaking up a little bit. Can you say that again? Oh, just when we start getting to the interesting answer. She's breaking up. Yeah, so
it's funny. I was wondering, her path is a bit in the tropics, isn't it? Isn't she staying semi-tropical in her voyage?
Yes, she is. She's mostly tropical right now. She's not going too far south.
Yeah, I wonder, because then it's interesting. It's quite likely that in that area there isn't as much upwelling and isn't as much of this sort of event that we're talking about, which is, it's kind of interesting, though.
Yeah. So, Roz, are you back?
I'm back. Yeah, sorry, I lost you there.
We'll love your answer again. We didn't catch any of it, unfortunately.
Oh, sorry about that.
That's okay.
I was just saying, 5 or 6 days ago, there was a relatively small patch of ocean that did seem a little bit more smelly in a fishy kind of way than the rest. And I thought, oh, that's odd, because I've never really experienced anything like that before. But could that have been one of these phytoplankton clumps?
Yeah, that's interesting. But I was reading, I should tell you this, about, do you know where the Gilbert Islands are? They're right on the equator. They're not probably that far from where you are now. I mean, relatively.
Yeah, that's where I left from.
Oh, the Gilbert. Yeah,
it's called Kiribati now. Used to be the Gilbert and Ellis Islands, and now it's known as Kiribati, I think. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not, it's a different name now. But there's some of these, you know, it's funny, there's because I study how these birds hunt over the ocean, and there was a magistrate that wrote a memoir of his time in the Gilbert Islands, and he described these patches of odor that the folks who lived there described, and they called them batias. They had a name for them. It was really funny. So, well, a long time ago, I wrote some article, and somebody out of New Zealand wrote me and told me about these books on the Gilbert Islands and how people there used these, they called them, they're sort of like sea marks, you know, for navigation. And I was wondering, that was just a curiosity of mine, because very few people talk about this stuff.
Interesting. Okay, I'm fascinated. How do you end up studying bird senses of smell? What is it about this field of study that that attracted you? It just sounds intriguing.
Oh, it's a little strange. I studied salmon navigation and homing for a long time, and they home using their sense of smell. And there happens to be I had a colleague who was working down in the southern oceans, down in Antarctica near South Georgia Island, actually, and where there are lots and lots of this group of bird called the Procellariiform seabirds, which are tube-nosed seabirds. And they were known for having very large olfactory systems, that's part of the brain that deals with the sense of smell. And so, but there hadn't been a whole lot of behavioral work done on them and figuring out how they hunt and forage and things like that. And so I got the opportunity through this colleague to start studying them. And it turned out that they were very sensitive to certain odors that we could measure over the ocean. And one of the odors was a sulfur-based odor, but it doesn't really smell sulfury. It's a dimethyl sulfide. It smells a little bit like oysters. And it's been studied. It happened to have been studied quite a lot in the context of global cooling. This is sort of in the days before climate change was such a hot topic, but it was a sulfur that's emitted by, it's produced in part by phytoplankton, and it's very abundant down in the southern oceans. And so we tested the birds to see whether they could smell and track, you know, aerosols of this particular odor, and we found that they could, and they were extremely sensitive to it. And so, but we were working more with birds like petrels and albatrosses and things like that. So we found out that they could detect scents from considerable distances, and that they use different scents for foraging, and that the way they hunted actually was going to not track individual prey items, but to locate areas where foraging was likely to be successful. And it might be thousands of kilometers away from where they are, but they navigate to these, you know, places to forage, sort of like you might go to the market, and then track and prey at a more local level, and then they go back to their breeding colony if they happen to be raising chicks, for example, at that time. So it kind of blossomed into a much bigger area of research. It is a strange area of research, I have to admit. What do you do? Well, I study, you know. But
I wrote Across Oceans as interesting conversations at cocktail parties.
Yeah, right. What's that about? So but then many of the birds that we study are now, you know, becoming critically endangered with long lining and different fishing practices, and so so some of the work we've done has been helpful in the sense that the mitigation for keeping birds off long lines is typically, a lot of it can endanger them even more, because it involves things like these long lines off of fishing boats can go off, as you probably know, it can be 100 miles long off a fishing boat, and the fishermen don't want the birds to get caught on the hooks, but they often do. And so one of the mitigations is to throw fish guts and stuff over the side to attract birds into the fish guts rather than on the hooks. And what we found is that actually brings in many, many, many more birds into these vulnerable areas. So those sorts of practices are not encouraged anymore, things like that.
Yeah. I'd love to hear more about that. I'm sorry, you're going to have to excuse me. I'm sorry to be rude, but I'm about to get hit by a squall and I need to batten down the hatches, put things away.
Goodness.
And then I probably really ought to get back to rowing, because I am drifting closer to dry land. So
yes.
I'm sorry. If I could leave you, Gabby and Kiki, to continue the conversation, I look forward to downloading and listening to the podcast when I get back to dry land, but I'm going to have to run.
Thank you so much for calling in today, Roz. I'm sorry you have the squall and you have the dry land to contend with, and we wish you the best of luck and safe
Thank
rowing.
Thank you very much.
Safe
and
rowing.
Thanks again, Gabby, for being our guest this week. And Kiki, I'll speak to you next week.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Be safe.
All right, take care.
Yeah,
you
too. Good luck. Sounds great.
Bye, Roz.
Thanks. Thank you. Bye.
Yeah, the one thing that you never can be sure of when you're listening to the Roz Rose podcast is exactly what is going to happen. You never quite know what the weather is going to be like out there for Roz and what she's going to be contending with. I know last year there were a couple of moments where she had to just row and row and row because she was contending with islands and coral reefs, and I believe that is the situation now. She's just north of the Solomon Islands at this point in time, for anyone who was interested in her location. In her journal, I believe, let's see if I can find the actual comment here, the journal entry, this is all so sudden. She talks about the fact that she is just above someplace, she was detouring around the bottom of New Britain, and where is she going? I think it said she said something about Hamdar, I believe, is the point. But she's currently located at latitude of -4.51798, longitude 154.96044. And that's her location currently. And so we hope that she doesn't run into that Solomon Island that with the beautiful white beach that she's talking about. As beautiful as it might be, it's probably not exactly where she wants to go. And we hope that she makes it all the way to Papua New Guinea. So, Gabby.
What would happen to her if she ended up landing inadvertently on one of these islands?
Most likely she has, it depends on where she lands and how, if there are people on the island, if it's populated, she has an emergency beacon, so she can, put up an emergency signal. She has the satellite phone, and I believe she has contact with people, so she can call and let people know where she is, and they'd probably send out a helicopter rescue crew if she's someplace difficult to get to. But if she's someplace, you know, fairly safe to get to, she, you know, they might just drive over and pick her up. I have no idea. And yeah, as she gets closer and closer to Papua New Guinea, she's just probably going to be running into more and more fishing boats and more people out. So the likelihood of, you know, ending up on a deserted beach is probably not quite as high as, you know, years past.
Yeah. Boy, that's a very interesting thing to be doing.
I know.
Mind-boggling, really, when you think about it. Boy.
Yeah, and hopefully the boobies that are landing on her boat and going to the bathroom on the solar panels aren't going to block out the solar panels too much for her to be able to get electricity. We want her to...
Yeah, that would be tough. That would be very tough. I suppose I'd want the company, but again, pooping on the solar panel doesn't sound too great.
No. So I was wondering to get to a nut here in your story of what you were talking about. You made a comment of research of the phytoplankton and the scents and the foraging of the birds, and that being related to global cooling from years back. Is there still research into this in terms of climate change and broader, more global issues?
Oh yeah. Of course there's obviously a huge interest in global cooling. Most of the attention right now is focused on CO2, but there's another compound, dimethyl sulfide, that's been actually studied quite extensively for the somewhat reverse effects. So that there's a fellow named Lovelock who you might have heard of. Have you ever heard of him? He was one of the investigators who came up with a hypothesis called the claw hypothesis, which was popularized as Gaia, the Gaia hypothesis, which that isn't really in the scientific literature, but it's in the popular literature.
Right.
And the idea behind this is based on this claw hypothesis is which is just an acronym of the guy's names, but the idea is that the Earth has Lovelock's big idea was that the Earth could be viewed as an organism, and that the organism maintain a certain homeostasis, which people, can take or leave. But the part that I think is kind of fascinating is that phytoplankton produce this compound, dimethyl sulfide, and the way it works is the phytoplankton, if they're crunched up, basically, this precursor gets released, and that's called DMSP, or dimethyl sulfonyl propionate. And this compound breaks up, and it's not, through a few processes, it gets degraded to DMS and another compound. And DMS, which is dimethyl sulfide, isn't very soluble, and it doesn't dissolve well in seawater, so it goes in the atmosphere. And that leads to these aerosols, sulfur aerosols, which in turn form clouds. They are the condensation nucleus for clouds. And so the idea, it's kind of neat. So this phytoplankton, which needs light to thrive, produces this stuff that produces clouds, and the clouds again downregulate the phytoplankton. So it's the cycle, which, it's sort of interesting that the cycle, keeps the Earth cool. Those clouds in turn increase reflection so that the sun's rays don't warm, the planet so much. So the idea is that you get cooling from this event. And so people have been really interested in this because one of the ideas for regulating climate on the planet, for example, people are talking about, there's a word for geoengineering, or there's a term for this, but the idea is that you can really change climate. So one of the ideas is to seed the ocean to produce, get these phytoplankton going to produce more, DMS that, again, would, help to cool the planet. So there's ideas about that. Whether they're successful or not, it's another story. And where I come in is nobody had looked at these compounds as having any relationship at all to the underlying ecology of the system. And so we found that, in fact, these compounds are actually scented, and the organisms that live in the ocean, including the birds and many fishes as well, are paying attention to the release and the production of these compounds and using them, to regulate their activities, including foraging activity. So it's an interesting area for trying to understand sort of how we say different food webs are linked together, how they actually function in almost a global way. So,
If you just look at it from, just a single organism, like the bird or just the phytoplankton, you don't actually see the connectedness of the entire system. But once you start putting all the pieces together, you start to see how reliant every organism is on the other.
Everything else. So another place where dimethyl sulfide is produced a lot is in coral reefs, in the coral reef system. So this is kind of interesting. In a coral, that we're all worried about corals dying out due to coral bleaching and also due to, other changes associated with climate change.
Yeah.
But one of the things that corals have in them are these organisms that are a kind of a plankton. They're called zooxanthellae, and it's a big, long name, but it's basically a symbiotic algae that lives with a coral or with also sea anemones we see in California. And so that's what makes the sea anemones green, and also gives coral some of its pigment as well. The giant clams that are so green inside have zooxanthellae that make them green. So when what happens, it's really interesting, these zooxanthellae, when the corals get stressed, they leave the coral, they leave the organism, and the zooxanthellae produce energy for the coral. They're photosynthesized, so they produce energy that the coral needs. And when they leave the coral, sometimes they die, and when they die, they give off a whole lot of this dimethyl sulfide, which is funny. But the other side of it is it's the interplay between these things is just fascinating. So it's not, you know, you don't usually think of just one organism, like you say. You think of the interplay between the whole system. That's what's really interesting.
Yeah, it seems like it. I mean, it just becomes a much more complicated story, a much more interesting story. When you start just delving into all of the different facets, it's just so neat.
Yeah, it's also funny too. You know, in our the way we live now, we're not always exposed to all the complexities of the natural world. So it's when you get into it, it really pulls you in. It must be interesting for this woman to be out there on the ocean rowing and in a sense being alone. I wonder if she feels alone.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think sometimes she likes being alone. I think Roz has said in a recent blog post that she's actually come across more boats and more people than she has for the past 3 weeks since she left Kiribati. And she was kind of upset that she had to actually see people.
It must be very different.
Yeah.
It must be a very different experience to be, you know, seeing people, and because that's a pretty populated area of the ocean, so that must be very interesting.
Yeah, and I believe like the other two legs of the trip that she's taken were not as populated, so she didn't run into as many people. It wasn't quite as, she had a lot more alone time, I think.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah,
I think she got used to that. And there's definitely, you know, something to be said for the experience of being alone and just being out there and just rowing and being a person on the ocean and being one with everything around you.
Yeah, I would imagine. I imagine that that's a difficult transition, too, to get back into a different sort of life once you re-enter society. Must be strange.
Yeah.
I already start thinking about it.
Yeah, well, we're hoping that she'll be able to have some people meet her wherever she ends up landing, because the currents and things have gone very favorably so far, and so she's ahead of schedule in terms of finishing her trip. And people who would have been there aren't going to be able to be there when she lands, and so Roz is slightly afraid that she's going to be pulling up to a dock and stepping off and having a beer by herself at the bar wherever she lands.
Oh, wow.
Which would be kind of anticlimactic. And it would just, so I'm hoping that people can meet her in Papua New Guinea wherever she lands and give her a good welcoming.
Yeah.
Welcoming home.
I would hope so too. That, especially in Papua New Guinea, you'd want to have, you know, people there for you. That's impressive.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's neat.
Yeah. So, Gabby, thank you so much for joining today and sharing your knowledge about olfaction and seabirds. And, you know, I know we only scratched the surface of the story, really, but it's fascinating, interesting work. And I think it really, really plays into Roz's message of environmental awareness and getting people to just be aware of the environment and our impacts on it, because there are these very complex webs that exist, and you can start out just by studying a bird and end up finding out so much more about the world.
That's absolutely true. That's well said, actually, because you can start out just looking at a bird in your yard and finding out so much more about the world if you take the time to actually look and actually look outside yourself a little bit. That's absolutely true. And, that's a great message to send out into the world, especially right now.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So thank you very much. And I hope to be speaking with you again soon. It was so great to be able to touch base. I didn't have a disclaimer on this one. Gabby was one of my advisors through graduate school, so...
No, she was a wonderful student.
Yeah, so...
Okay, yeah, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you very much, Gabby. Have a great evening. Thanks for joining us on Roz Rose today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, bye. See you later. This is the end of Roz Rose. Unfortunately, we have come to the end of another program. This has been episode 65. It's a scratch and sniff world, people. It really is. And I just want to remind people that they can keep up with Roz's voyage in between our little visits. And today was unfortunately all too brief. But as I said, you never know exactly what is going to hit in the environment that Roz is in. We don't have any meetings beforehand to discuss what's going to be on the show and how the show is going to go and whether or not everything's going to work out. We are really at the beck and call of the elements and the technology. But Roz, as always, has a wonderful, wonderful cheer to her, and she just... We can all take a lesson, folks. We can all take a lesson from the woman in the rowboat. Thanks for Dr. Nevitt for joining us on Roz Rose. If you want any more information about what she does, she is a professor at UC Davis and in the Department of Neurobiology, Physiology, and Behavior. You can find her on the NPB website at ucdavis.edu. Additionally, you can follow Roz at rozsavage.com. Her Twitter account is at rozsavage. And you can download past Roz Rose episodes from twit.tv/Roz. We'd like to also remind you to vote in the Blue Frontier campaign for Roz and Margot. Vote in the Blue Frontier campaign, please, everybody. And remember the Eco Heroes. If you haven't signed up yet, you can still sign up to be an Eco Hero. And you can find information about all these things at rozsavage.com. I'm Dr. Kiki, and thank you so much for joining us this week. We will be back next week, hopefully touching in yet again to find out where in the world Roz is. Until then, keep rowing.